The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Robin Yocum. He joins us on the telephone in Delaware County. His new novel is called The Last Hitman. Welcome back, Robin.
Well, hey, Vic, thanks for having me back. It's been a while, but I appreciate it. Back on the show.
It has been a while, and I'm so glad you got a hold of me because I absolutely love this new novel, and I want to know how you got the idea for it.
Okay, well, sure. It actually started as a short story. I did a short story for Strand Magazine a few years back, which was picked up as part of the Best American Mystery Stories of 2020. And it was about this aging mob hitman who's outlived his usefulness to the family. They've gone away from prostitution and gambling and more into drugs, and they really don't need a guy like Angelo anymore. So the FBI is trying to flip him because they know he's outlived his usefulness. And, of course, the family finds out, and they send a hitman to take out Angelo. And that's where the short story ends. And when I got done, I just felt like Angelo had more to say. In most of my books, in the books, by the time I get to the end of it, I'm usually tired of my characters and I want them to go away. But after the short story, I just felt like he had more to say, and I wanted to find out where he came from and how he got into the mob and what happens. I don't want to give away too much spoiler alerts, but what happens after the mob sends a hitman to take him out?
Well, it's funny that you would say that at the end of your short story, you felt like he had more to say, because that's the way I felt at the end of the novel. I felt like, gee, is there going to be another book with Angelo in it? I felt like you kind of left the door slightly cracked.
And I did that intentionally. Yes, I did that intentionally. This was my ninth book, seventh novel, and only two of them, Favorite Sons and The Sacrifice of Lester Yates, have the same characters.
Mm.
Because I have others that I want to write. But I just wanted to leave that open for Angelo. That he gets pulled back in, and I've been kicking around an idea for a sequel, haven't been able to come up with. I'm working on a couple of other projects right now, so I've got time, but I've got to come up with a good ending. I won't put words on page one until I know what words I'm going to put on the last page when I'm working on a book, and I just don't want to commit till I'm sure I've got a good story there, because I wouldn't want people to be disappointed or feel like I was just mailing it in.
You always know the endings before you start?
Always, always. I will start with, and these are my terms, just that launch point, which is that one little germ of an idea that makes me think, I bet I could put a book together, wrap a book together around this idea. And then I spend weeks or months just thinking about the book, not... I don't worry about spelling, grammar. It's idea generation. And until I've kind of laid out the book in my head, how it's going to plan out. But I always have to have the ending. I feel like I can draw the roadmap to get there as long as I know where there is. If I don't know how the book's going to end, I feel like I'd just be out there spinning my wheels.
Hmm.
And I think we've all read books where, and it looks like they end when the writer just got tired of working on it and said, okay, you know, the end. And I'm more of a, I guess, bottled up, buttoned up kind of guy. I have to know how that ends before I start writing it.
I've never read a book like that. I'm just kidding. My guest is my guest is Robin Yocum, and the new one is The Last Hitman. Tell our listeners how you know so much about this area. And these crime families, this is a great background that I think they need to be aware of.
Well, I was the crime reporter at the Columbus Dispatch for years. Did the night police beat for a long time. And, the best education a young reporter can have, doing the crime beat. And then I did day cops. I covered organized crime, but I grew up over in eastern Ohio, the Ohio River Valley, where my books are set, near Steubenville. And in those days, Steubenville boomed. There were 60,000 steel mill jobs in Weirton, West Virginia, and across the river in Steubenville, and moving down the river about 20 miles, 60,000. Hmm. And my dad always said the reason the economy down there boomed so much was because, steel workers spent every dime they made, and they spent a lot of it on in the brothels on Water Street in Steubenville and on Wheeling Island, and gambling. I could get the football parlay sheets in my high school. And I said, for a while, I wasn't even sure it was illegal, but we had a guy that you'd pass them out and you'd give them $2. And if you could pick three winners, you got $6 back. And it was very, very commonplace. My grandmother, when I was young, my grandmother would stop at Lane's Lounge in Mingo Junction, Ohio. And I would go in there with her. Now, she was going in to play the number. I didn't know it. I didn't know what the number was when I was 6 years old. But all I can remember was Louis Lane sold newspapers, cigars, and chewing gum, and had this really nice house up on the hill. And I kept thinking, the markup on chewing gum must be astronomical, because how are you making all this money? But he was making it on the VIG. He was taking, bets for the mob. And in those days, the Youngstown mob in Steubenville. In my book, I create a mob family specifically for Steubenville. I had a little bit of literary license there. But it was, it was what I grew up with. Everyone knew who ran the brothels. Everyone knew, where every bar and American Legion and VFW up and down the river, you could get a spot sheet and play it, no problem. And everyone knew it. And it just was sort of the fabric of the area in which I grew up.
You can't do that anymore? I'm shocked. It's the lottery. Well, the lottery took away all that gambling, didn't it?
That's what happened. Mm-hmm. Once the state got involved in it, that took away a lot of what the mob was doing anyway. And, the steel mill jobs are gone.
Mm-hmm.
Those 60,000 jobs have all left. And the companies that were there to get the steel are gone. And the companies that supplied the steel mills are gone.
Mm.
It's the Ohio Valley is just, it's a very sad area right now, because there's no work. Well, once all that went away, the mob's customer base went away, and that hurt them. And as well as the state governments, and plus, you can bet online now. You don't have to go down to Lane's Lounge and put your bet on. You can do it on your iPhone. So,
okay.
They're just their market dried up for a variety of reasons.
And I assume, as in your book, that organized crime turned to bringing in stuff like fentanyl, because in these depressed areas, you have a lot of depressed people taking drugs. And I'm wondering, was there really an Italian slum in Steubenville that they called the Spaghetto?
The Spaghetto was actually a term I heard from a friend of mine who grew up in Steubenville. And I keep a little book. I've got it right here on my shelf, and I pretty much carry it wherever I go. And every time I hear a term like the Spaghetto, or a funny story, or a name I like, I incorporate it in that book and then look for ways to use it when I'm writing. I gave a talk in Barnesville, Ohio, a couple years ago, and at a high school, and the teacher asked me, she said, "Do you think you could put my late uncle's name in one of your books?"
Mm.
I said, "Well, I might. What's your uncle?" She said, "Muzzy Lolini." And I said, "Absolutely, count on it." I said, "I got one I'm working on right now, and Muzzy is a great name for Muzzy Lolini would be a great name for a character." So that's a lot of that is where I come from. Now, there were obviously areas of Steubenville and down that were right down by the mill, you know, and in Weirton, across the river, Weirton, West Virginia, which is where my dad worked as a steel worker, the mill was first, and the town grew up literally right around that mill. So, you know, there were very rough areas and poor areas of Steubenville, but the Spaghetto was my invention.
I love it. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling on the air and online. It's the Book Nook. My guest is Robin Yoakum. He's joined us on the telephone in Delaware County. His new book is called The Last Hitman, and Angelo grows up in the Spaghetto. And you have this book set up so that we have these continuous flashbacks where the aging Angelo, who's in his late 60s, is looking back at how he got into this crime family and then the various crimes that he did. And one of my favorite series is by Lawrence Block, and it's not his better known one. It's about a guy named Tanner, who's a hitman and also a stamp collector. And I love that series. And so when I started reading about Angelo, I said, man, I love this guy. He's the most sympathetic character, and he's killing all these people. And like, we don't feel bad about it, do we?
Well, and I will tell you, Vic, I cheated a little bit there. And because what I tried to do was – When he takes someone out, they are generally people that the reader won't care if they're gone or not. I mean, in a lot of respects, that was a challenge when I was writing this. Is, you know, it's 325 pages, and you want your reader to cheer for your protagonist, and you know, he's a mob hitman.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to show some humanity there. And I tried to show his love interest, where, you know, he's this tough guy, he's this mob hitman, but yet he's intimidated by the waitress at the diner who he's in love with, thinks she's out of his league and won't pull the trigger and ask a bad term a phrase there, pull the trigger, but afraid to ask her out.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's got his buddy Nichols, who's across the river in Weirton, West Virginia, in a nursing home after getting his leg amputated, who has these delusions when they keep him, because they're keeping him all drugged up. But Angelo goes over to see him, you know, when Big Tommy, the former head of the mob, is gone. You know, he takes cookies to his wife and tries to take her out for lunch. So I am trying to show some humanity about him, while at the same time, you know, he and Carlo, when they were teamed up, were pretty bad guys and taking out a lot of guys up and down the valley.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I feel like I cheated a little bit and made the ones he was taking out not the best guys.
Well, it works. And Angelo, you just mentioned Carlo. Angelo learns how to become a hitman from Carlo, and Carlo's another really great character. You mentioned Nichols. When we get to the end of the book and you bring Nichols back into it, this is the most hilarious thing. The interplay between these two guys as they're cruising around doing what they're doing is absolutely hysterical. I laughed and laughed and laughed. I had so much fun reading that. I can't remember the last time I enjoyed reading a novel as much.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, you know, there's always guys are guys. I've always felt like, you know, guy, you know, you can wear a suit and be working on Wall Street or in the steel mill or in the mob, and guys are guys, and they have a certain friendship and a language with each other, where especially in the steel mills or back in that blue collar area where I grew up. I mean, insults, if people weren't insulting you, they didn't like you. You know? I mean, there was always that interaction. And I tried to put myself into that. And when I will tell you, because it's telling first person, I'm always looking at the world through my eyes. when I'm telling a story like that. So, you know, he breaks Nichols out of the nursing home, and Nichols is still, he doesn't quite have his bearings as he's getting started, you know, as they get out of there, because he's been doped up so much. So I thought there was a lot of opportunity there. And I love the interaction with Nichols and Carolyn, who at this point is Angelo's girlfriend, you know, where he's kind of spitting on his hand and trying to get his hair to look nice when he's meeting Carolyn. So, yeah, I enjoyed that, and I enjoyed writing it. I enjoyed writing it, and I said, you know, Vic, I'm my own best friend, and I will tell you, I was kind of chuckling while I was writing it also.
I'm sure you were. Yeah, that had to be so much fun to write those parts. My guest is Robin Yoakam, and we're talking about The Last Hitman. And Angelo is half Italian. His dad was Italian, but his mom was Ukrainian. And when he gets the gig with the Fortunato crime family in Steubenville, this creates a situation where he can never really be a made man in their parlance. And he goes through three crime bosses. We start off with Alphonse Fortunato, and then his son Big Tommy takes over, and then eventually Little Tommy takes over. And we watch through flashbacks these progressions. And I loved it that you had a gangster named Alphonse, because when I was a kid, I had a paper route, and I had a gangster on my route named Alphonse. And he was a notorious gangster back in the day. He's a bootlegger back during Prohibition, and just an amazing guy, larger than life, very Italian. At Christmas, he used to give me a $100 tip. And this is back when $100 was a lot of money for a 12-year-old paperboy. The Fortunatos, let's talk about this family. Alphonse is old school. So is Big Tommy. But Little Tommy, not so much.
Not so much. Not so much. And Little Tommy, just not a good guy, which is sort of saying it mildly. But he's waiting in the wings. His dad isn't that old. And his dad is very old school and wants to keep things the way they've always been. You know, the world he knows: gambling, prostitution, loan sharking. Little Tommy is waiting in the wings, and he desperately wants the family to move toward drugs. He eventually becomes head of the family, and his father's body isn't even cold in the grave when he starts moving them toward drugs. And this is what ultimately caused the severing of Angelo with the family. Even though, you know, he's taken an oath and he promised Little Tommy's dad, Big Tommy, that he would take care of the boy, the boy doesn't want to listen. And Angelo knows this all along. He knows when the old man dies, he's going to get put on the shelf because the young kid is not going to listen to him. And that really, because what Angelo says, and he talks about this right in the prologue of the book, you know, respect ought to be a two-way street. Yeah, he did take an oath to be loyal to the family, but he expected the family to be loyal in return. Mm-hmm. Once young Tommy takes over, all bets are off, and he's bringing in his crew. You know, it's almost like a new college football or pro football coach comes in. He wants his guys. Mm-hmm. You know, the other guys get fired and hit the road. This is the same thing. He wants the guys who are thinking the way he's thinking, and we're going to go after drugs. And Angelo admits, he said, my God, the money he's making bringing, you know, selling drugs, you know, far outpaced anything his dad did with the traditional mob revenue streams. Mm-hmm. But it's also a lot more dangerous. People didn't consider prostitution and gambling, they were victimless crimes. And obviously fentanyl and cocaine and meth are not.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, you've created some lovable gangsters here. I'd say Angelo is lovable, so is Nichols. Alphonse and Big Tommy are somewhat lovable. Little Tommy, we hate him. And then there's Carlo. And I love Carlo because he's the guy who takes on Angelo as his protege and shows him how it's done. And he's got this ethical code about how he kills people. And everything that he does, there's all – I was reading this and I was thinking, how does Robin know this?
Well, you know, I've read a lot and, you know, I covered the crime beat for years. I talked to a lot of cops. I can't tell you exactly how I know a lot of this stuff. It's just sort of ingrained. You know, the one thing people will ask me, do you use the crime beat or, you know, stories on the crime beat for your books? And my usual response is no, because I'm not taking – you know, I'm not looking at a case that actually happened and then trying to fictionalize it. You know, everything in my book is the novel is coming out of, my imagination. But I probably don't give myself enough credit for what I learned on the crime beat that is just simply second nature to me. I mean, I know how cops investigate a homicide. I know the procedures they use through the legal system and what cops on the street are looking for and how all that fits together. And consequently, yeah, I mean, I've gone to penitentiaries numerous times to conduct interviews. One of the books that I would like to do in the next year or so will actually be nonfiction, and it'll be a biography of a career criminal that I've been in contact with for 40 years.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Who is it? Come on, tell us who it is.
It's a guy named John Spirko, S-P-I-R-K-O. And if you live in Western Ohio, you might remember he was convicted of the 1982 murder of the female postmaster in a little town called Elgin, which is just west of Lima. John's been in prison. He was actually sentenced to death. Governor Strickland commuted his sentence. John's a bad dude, but I would bet every nickel I own that he did not kill that female postmaster. He's the only guy I know that had nothing to do with the crime, inserted himself into the investigation, managed to get himself indicted and convicted and sentenced to death row.
Oh, no, really?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, gee.
It's a fascinating story.
I can see that. Wow.
But
that's going to be a book? You're going to write a book about this?
Put a book together. I actually wrote one years ago about John, and the publishing houses told me, wow, fascinating book, great research, good job, no thank you. This guy is such a miserable human being that nobody will care that he's on death row for a crime he didn't commit. So I'm going to take a different approach to it this time and see if I can pull it off.
Cool. Well, I'm curious. Carlo, one of his ethical standards that he teaches Angelo is where to shoot these people. There's preferred spots where to shoot the victims of their crimes, and he never shoots them in the face so the family can have an open casket funeral. Now, I'm wondering, did you make that up or did you hear that somewhere?
No, my understanding is that was a code with some mobsters.
Okay.
Because you don't shoot them in front of the family, in front of the kids or in front of the wife or the mother, and you don't shoot them in the face so they can have an open casket.
Okay.
And that was, and I can't tell you how I knew that or where I read that or how I gained that knowledge, but I wanted to pass that along to Carlo because he was more of your traditional mob hitman, I think.
And Carlo also is really the key who unlocks everything in this story. After you read the story, you'll go, oh, Robin was very clever with Carlo and what he does with Carlo. And the cops in this, the FBI is sniffing around. They want Angelo to squeal. They want Nichols to squeal. And when we get to the end, the whole thing with pizza, I love the pizza conversation they have with the mobster where they're arguing about who has the best pizza.
Who has the best pizza. So I in every book, because all my books are set down on the river, I usually will mention Iron City Beer, Dean Martin, and DiCarlo's Pizza, which is a Sicilian style pizza that I grew up with. I think it's the greatest pizza in the world, and that's what they end up arguing about, in the one scene. And I took my wife before we got married, back home, and I got her DiCarlo's Pizza, and she ate it and looked at me and said, I don't get it. And I said, I don't know that I want to marry you now. This is the way you're going to treat DiCarlo's Pizza. But it's an Ohio Valley thing. And I did want to work that in to the scene right near the end of the book where they're arguing about DiCarlo's. I had some fun with that too.
Yeah, you got Dean Martin out of the way in a hurry. Now, he was from Steubenville, wasn't he?
Correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. He was born in Steubenville, and they have a festival there every summer, the Dean Martin Festival.
And what does that involve?
So, they'll bring in some Dean Martin impersonators, there's always a show or two, and the traditional type festivals with food trucks and to be really honest with you, I've always wanted to go back for one but haven't done it. One year they brought in Dina. His daughter, and she performed. And I mean, they're very, very proud of the fact that his name was Crocetti, Dino Crocetti, and changed his name to Dean Martin for show business purposes.
You're making me want to go listen to my Dino, Desi, and Billy 45s now.
There you go. Pull those out. I've got some Dean CDs right here in front of me.
Okay.
Well, I'm not buying any more music. I've got CDs. They'll be here when I die.
Nice. Well, it's really been great talking to you, Robin. And I have just one more question, and I don't expect an answer. But this is the question that I was left with at the end of The Last Hitman. This is the one that stuck with me. Was the prune Danish real or an hallucination?
Don't answer that.
But that was the question that I had. Along with whether there's going to be another book with Angelo, of course.
Yeah. Well, I you know what? I wanted you to have that question.
Okay.
So it's great that's what you came up with at the end of the book. Yeah.
I love it. Well, thanks again for your time, Robin, and for the book.
No, I thank you, Vic. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I appreciate your time.
You've been listening to Book Nook, and my guest has been Robin Yoakum. And this new one, published by Crooked Lane, is The Last Hitman, and it's a Book Nook page turner for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.